So at this time, I would like to turn the meeting over to the home brewmeister, Clarence.
Well, thank you very much. As you have already found out, I am Clarence Snyder, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. Thank you. You're all very, very kind. Last night, we were talking about a lot of the beginnings and things attended to the beginnings of AA. And I mentioned last night that today we would get into talking about the program. AA has grown so, and it's taken so many different directions since its inception, that I am very cognizant of the fact that a lot of people are having a hard time grasping this program because in so many places it has been so watered down it's hardly recognizable. That's not a criticism, that's an observation. And as far as I'm concerned in AA, I am a fundamentalist. I came in a certain way, and I was very fortunate in that I came in the manner that I did, and under the tutelage and direction of the people who took charge of me when I arrived here. Because I was brought into this program with some absolutes, and I was taught that there are certain things that I should believe in and that I should stand for. And I was further taught that if you don't stand for something, you're very apt to fall for most anything. Last night I mentioned that while I was in the hospital, my sponsor, Doc Smith, put me on my knees and made me acknowledge that I believed in God. It was something of a threat, or at least I took it that way, but I took it. I was not one that was in a position to argue about anything, because I was washed out. And I see people come into AA today and they have an idea, or somebody gives them the idea that they can have choices on what they can do in this program. Well, you can have choices because we are people of that have a will of our own, but I'll tell you one thing, we have a program of perfection here, and being alcoholics, one of the characteristics of the alcoholic is he is an extremist. He never does anything by halfway measures. When he works hard, he plays hard, and when he drinks, he makes a career out of it. And if we're going to recover from such a living, we better go into this with extreme also. That would be my advice. I think I mentioned last night or sometime or other, I mentioned since I've been here, that alcoholism is probably the oldest malady that afflicts the human race. And we read about it in mythology, we read about it in ancient history, and we read about it in the Bible. Last night I mentioned that I would tell you a few Bible stories just to bring it to your attention that alcoholism has been with us a long, long time. Well, you know, when we open the Bible, we don't have to go any further than the first book of the Bible, book of Genesis, and we meet our first rummy. We meet our friend Noah. He was one of us. And I'll point out the reasons I believe this to be. The world got itself in a shape about the way it is now, everything going downhill, hell-bent for election. And God was doing everything he could to get people straightened out and get running straight in doing their thing. And he wasn't having much success with it. So we finally got fed up with the whole deal and decided to wipe the whole thing out and start all over again. So he determined that he would flood this world and everything in it. So, but he wanted some seed to start over new. So he went to his friend Noah. He says, "Noah, my boy," he says, "I want you should do something for me." And Noah, being a God-fearing man, he says, "Anything, Lord, what do you want me to do?" He says, "I want you to build a big boat, this ark." And he gave him the dimensions of this boat and told him that, "I want you to build that, and when you have completed it, I want you to put one of, or two of every living creature in that ark, and also your family, because I'm going to destroy the world, and I want some seed to start all over again." Noah says, "I will do that." So Noah and his family got out there cutting logs and sawing wood and hammering and getting this ark put together, and it took them several years to do this. Well, of course, you know, when you're doing anything, people get curious. So people, the neighbors came by and said, "What are you doing, Noah?" "Well, I'm building a boat." "You're building a boat out here in the middle of the desert?" "Yeah." He says, "What for?" He says, "We're going to have a flood, and everything's going to be washed away." Well, you can imagine what the neighbors had to say about this. They tapped their head. "Poor old Noah, he's playing with a short deck. Poor Noah has lost some shingles off the roof." So they laughed at him, go on their way. So finally the ark was completed, and Noah got all these creatures in the ark and his family, and they closed the doors. And some of those neighbors, they saw this rain coming up, and that boy had rained and had rained for 40 days and 40 nights. Some of them were beaten on the door, but the doors did not open for anyone. So the ark rose on this water and started floating around for a good long period of time. Finally, this ark, the waters began to recede, and the ark came down and settled on Mount Ararat. The ground came up and everything was dry. And what was the first thing our friend Noah did? He ran out there, he planted a vineyard, he raised some grapes, he made some wine, and he got drunk. And boy, what a mess he made out of himself. Read that part of the book of Genesis and you'll meet your first rummy in AA, in history. In the Bible, there are also a couple other good stories I like. There are several of them, but I like the... I'm going to tell you about a couple that I particularly enjoy. One of them is a story of the Good Samaritan. Boy, there's a rummy story for you. Picture this. This lad is lying over there on the side of the road, stark naked, all beat up and half dead. He don't have a stitch of clothes. Everything has been taken from him. He's lying there naked. And you know what happened to him, don't you? He got drunk and he got rolled. I don't know if any of you ever got rolled, but he did. So along came a priest, and he saw this man lying along the side of the road. And the priest, being a man of the world, he's seen drunks lying around before and rolled. So he looks at him and he says, "Like you hear today. You still hear the same thing today. Good enough for him. The dirty, stinking, drunken bum, he got himself in that condition. Let him get himself out the best he can." And he crossed the way and let the poor guy lying there in his misery. So along came a Levite. And he saw this fellow there. And he's a man of the world. And he repeated the same thing that the priest had said. The dirty, stinking, drunken bum. He got himself in that shape, let him get himself out of it, and he passed on the other side and left him lying there. Along comes this Samaritan fellow, and he was a traveling salesman. I'll prove that to you. And he was, of course, the Samaritans were not the chosen people around there in that time, But he was there, and he came by in his former conveyance. It certainly wasn't a Chevrolet. It was probably a mule. And he sees this fellow lying there, and did he pass him by? Not by a jugful. He got down off of his conveyance, and what did he do? It tells you very plainly what he did. He gave him some wine. He gave him a drink. And he poured some wine in his wounds. And did he leave him lying there? Nope. He picked him up, put him on his former conveyance, and took him to the Holiday Inn. Well, it says he took him to an inn. And here's how I know they're all rummies. He goes to this inn, and he took this fellow and deposited him there, and he says to the innkeeper, "Mr. Innkeeper, take care of this fellow, and here is some money." You see, he gave the money to the innkeeper, not the drunk. He knew that much. And he says, "If there be any more due, I will repay you on my next visit through," which means he's a traveling salesman making that territory. There is a first 12-step call on record. It's right in the Bible. One other story I like in the Bible is a story of these two boys, the prodigal son. Boy, here is a rummy story par excellence. Here's these two kids, and they're Jewish kids. I want to keep this in mind. They're Jews. And they work for their dad. Their father has a big spread there, and he has cows and goats and sheep and everything, no hogs, but everything else he has there. And, of course, in Jewish lore, why, the boys work for their father, and when the father passes away, of course, they inherit the estate and the property. They get the loot that the old man leaves. So these two kids are working out here on this farm for their father. And this one kid, the older one, boy, he does more than he's supposed to do. He's a worker. Boy, he's into everything, doing a lot more than his father expects him to do. He's the Al-Anon kid. But the other kid, the young one, guess who? This young one, he doesn't like working on that farm in the first place, and he wants his share of the loot right now. You ever hear anybody here feel that way? He can't wait till tomorrow for it. He don't want to wait till some indefinite time when his father dies and he gets that loot. He's young, and he wants it when he can enjoy it. So he bugs his father and bugs his father and bugs his father for his share of the loot. Finally, the father can't take it anymore, and he says, "Okay, take your share and be gone with it." And boy, he did. So he took his share, and what does it say in the Bible? He says he went into a far country, and he squandered his substance in riotous living. Did you ever hear anything like that? He blew the whole bundle. The whole thing went. And he was tapped out, and he's flat, and he's broke. Now, that isn't the worst yet. He was in this foreign country, and they had a famine there. And he couldn't get any work. He couldn't get anything to eat. He's about to starve to death. And the only surcease that he got a job where? Now, remember, this kid's a Jew. He got a job on a hog farm, taking care of a bunch of hogs. Did he eat what the hogs ate? No, siree. It says in a good book he ate of the husks of the hog, of the food that the hogs ate. He ate what the hogs wouldn't eat. This is what he ate. I'd say this kid pretty well hit his bottom, wouldn't you? So here's what he did, something very important he said, and the same thing that you and I had to say. It says he came to himself, and he said this. He says, "I starve. My father has much. His servants have much. I am starving." Then he said this. He says, "I will arise and go to my father and tell him I'm unworthy. And I will serve as one of his servants." Remember that. This is what we had to do. So that kid got up off his duff and started that long trek home, defeated, sick, beaten, fearful, and he had to go to meet his father. Well, that is what happened when he got home. Did his father chew him out? No, siree. It says in there, his father saw him coming afar off down the road, and he ran to him, and he fell on his neck, and he kissed him. He says, my son, who is dead, is alive. He says, let us make merry. Put a ring on his finger, shoes on his feet, a cloak on his back. Let us go up and have a party. Let us kill the fatted calf and have a feast. So the kid's protesting that he isn't worthy of this, but the father assures him that he belongs to him, and he says, my son who is dead is alive. Let us have a celebration. So they go up the house, and boy, they're having a blast up there. The old music is going, they're singing and dancing, and they're eating and having a big old time. Meantime, this Al-Anon kid, he's still out there going at it, working away like a good Al-Anon should. And he hears all this ruckus up at the house, so a servant came by and said, hey, what's all that ruckus at the house, the music and all that noise going on up there? He says, haven't you heard? He says, heard what? He says, your brother came home. He says, oi, that dirty no good. So then he drops his tools and went up to the house to confront his father. Now, this is a very human thing. He says, father, I have been a good son to you. I have always done more than is required of me. You had no problems with me, and I'm here working with you. But this no good brother of mine, you give him his share of the inheritance, and he squandered it all on wine, women, and song. And he comes back here, and you have a party for that dub. He says, father, you never had a party for me. Isn't that human? So the father had to straighten him out, and he had to tell him what this was and the reason for it. It's a great story of the second chance, a great story of redemption, which you and I all have experienced coming to this fellowship. So that's a good rummy story. Well, anyway, so much for the Sunday school lesson. This thing of alcoholism is as old as time. And do you know that all down through history, there was never any solution for the alcoholic? As I mentioned the other night, he had two options. The alcoholic can go crazy or die or both. A little over 40 years ago, when Alcoholics Anonymous came into being, after all this thousands of years of history of alcoholics and millions of alcoholics stumbling across this face of this earth and dying and in misery and what have you, and carrying a lot of people down with them, finally after this time, this program came into being, and the alcoholic got a third option. He can still go crazy, he can still die, but he can get well. And this was never in essence before. Never. You know, I think that God looked down on these rummies finally and saw what was going on after all these years. He says, I got to do something for those birds. And he got a bunch of people whom you would least expect to do anything, get them together, and here's what we have. Well, I'm forever thankful that I came along when I did. I was a complete washout. As I mentioned the other night, I was on the bum for quite a long time. And I was without everything. And I've mentioned to some people, when I look back on those days and my arrival here and what happened to me in the first years of my AA history, if I were to pick someone to do that job that I was required to do, I would be the last guy I'd pick, because I wasn't prepared for it in any way, shape, or manner. I was broke. I was homeless. I had no clothes. I had no front. I had no health. I weighed 130 pounds. I was unemployable. I had no education. I'm a high school dropout. And I had to go out and confront people of letters to make to establish contacts in order to have rummies sent to us and things like that. Had to build up associations with hospitals, with the medical fraternity, with the churches and so forth. And I'll never forget, I just want to tell you this. I went to churches and I used to talk, they talk about, I'm to you, when I listen to some of this crap that people give you, you should be so anonymous. If I was that way, you wouldn't have an AA. Really, this is ridiculous. Somebody's got to go out and tell somebody about it. This isn't going to happen like this. Somebody has to tell somebody. So I went out and told people, besides rummies. I went to the various churches. This is from, do you believe that some of these preachers in some of these churches resisted? They thought we were starting some new kind of religion to compete with them. No kidding. So one thing I want to tell you about the Catholics. We eventually got Catholics in our group. It didn't take us long. We started getting them because Cleveland was full of them. And after this, I'd been talking a lot. I went out and spoke to the Ministerial Association, all the ministers that met in groups. Then I worried about the Catholic Church because they had different ideas about things, and this fellowship of ours came out of the Oxford movement, which was strictly a Protestant evangelical movement. So I didn't expect to get any great hurrahs from the Catholic Church, but I didn't want to get any resistance from them either, which I got from some of the other denominations. So I thought I went to see some priests. Well, in my ignorance, I didn't know any better. I could find out that you can't get any place going to priests about anything in policy of the Catholic Church. You have to go to the bishop. So, well, I'll go see the bishop. I'm just that stupid. I don't know any better. So I head down to the bishop's office downtown, 9th and Superior, and go up there, and I wander into the office of the Catholic diocese, and a lady comes to me, and very nicely, polite, and smiling, she says, "And what can we do for you?" I said, "I came here to see the bishop." "Oh, you came to see the bishop. How nice." She says, "Follow me." So she takes me through a door into a room here, through another door and another room, another door, and I'm out in the hall where I started from. She threw me out of there so nicely. I stood out there in the hall and I laughed. It hit me funny. I said, "Boy, these Catholics are really organized." So I'm out. It dawned upon me that there's certain protocol you go through if you want to meet the bishop. He isn't like walking in and seeing a sales manager somewhere. He's somebody else. But I prayed about this, and I prayed, and I know that someday God would prepare it that I can see that bishop somehow or some way. So sometime later, this was winter time again. As I said last night, everything happens to me in the winter. I'm reading the evening paper, and I read where the good bishop came out of his office that day and slipped on the ice, and his feet went up in the air, and he came down and broke his leg. And they carted him off to St. Vincent's Charity Hospital. And I read that, and I read it again. I says, "God is working. I'm going to see the bishop." Well, I know it was no use running down to see him right now because everyone's going to be in there telling him, they're going to be telling him how sorry they are, he got hurt and all this sort of thing, and he has papers to sign, and he'll be very busy for a while in spite of all this. So I gave him a rest. He's going to be there for some time. So I waited a couple of weeks, almost three as I remember, and I thought the good Lord ordained that this is a time to go see the bishop. So I put an AA book under my arm. I had a copy of The Upper Room, that Methodist publication. We used to pay a nickel and ran for 3 months. That was our daily reading. I put that in my pocket, and I went down to Charity Hospital. And through some devious interrogation of a couple of student nurses, I found out what room the good bishop was in. So I hiked myself up there, and I walked past his door, and there he is, and they're all by himself, and his legs up in the air in traction. And he's reading a book. He's all by himself. I was right. The people are neglecting him now. So fools rush in where angels fear to tread. So I bust right into the bishop's room, and I introduce myself, and lo and behold, he's glad to see somebody. He's lonesome. Nobody's paying attention to him anymore, and he's used to a lot of attention. So he asked me what my pleasure was, and I told him that I wanted to talk to him about something about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started explaining this to him. He listened. Finally, he says, "Well, that sounds like the Oxford movement to me." I says, "Well, it was, but it isn't." And I tried to explain why we broke out of the Oxford movement. That seemed to satisfy him. So then I said to him, I said, "We have a book here. I would like for you to read this book." He says, "I'll be glad to. I have plenty of time. Give me the book." So I handed him the AA book, and then I sprung this upper room on him. I says, "Here's what we use for daily reading." I says, "I presume you may have something more appropriate for your folks," because he knew this was put out by the Southern Methodist Church. And he's, "Oh, no, that's all right. That won't hurt them. They can use it." You know, I never forget that. "It won't hurt them," he says. I says, "Well, I presume you may have something more appropriate for your folks." He says, "Well," I says, "we have a literature, the table, that's pretty bare, and we like anything we can find in a line of spiritual literature that we can read and so forth." He said, "You want some things?" I says, "Yes, I would appreciate it." He sent us bales of stuff, and we just filled our table full of our literature table, and that literature table was something else. I'm not kidding you. We always had this stuff on there, and we got some Emmett Fox stuff on there. And we had always a big book. When the meeting was concluded, that table was as clean as a hound's tooth. They took everything off it, including the book. And they didn't seem to pay for the book either. So that's how we got cooperation. We never had any problem with the Catholic Church. First thing you know, he starts sending some of his drunken priests into us. So we had no problem with them when we got full cooperation, more than I ever would hope to have, and it was good. So those are some little things that happened. I mentioned a while ago about how I came into this fellowship. When I was in the hospital, I mentioned last night how Doc put me on my knees, making me acknowledge that I believed in God before I ever got out of that hospital. After I was in the Oxford movement for a couple of months or so, I was listening to this stuff. I didn't know a whole lot that was going on, but the people there, the men, and also the non-alcoholics in there, they had a great fellowship going there, and they were talking God all the time. They read out of the Bible, and they had other spiritual things that they read, and they had a program that we were supposed to live by. The first thing when we got up in the morning, it told us in the Bible we should go in our secret closet and commune with God. So as a funny thing, you go into any alcoholic's home and go into the bathroom and sit down, and you'll find a Bible in there and a copy of the upper room. They figured that was their secret closet. They took it quite literally. But we were taught to have communion every morning with our Maker. There was no, when AA program was put together, I want to mention this because it's very important. There were two schools of thought, two philosophies in AA. There was a New York philosophy and there was the Ohio philosophy. And never the twain shall meet. And there was friction from the very beginning. The people in New York, Bill Wilson, Hank Parkhurst, and Burwell, and all those birds up there, they professed atheism and agnosticism. Over in the Midwest, they called us the Bible punchers, because we laid God right on the line, and they didn't like this up in New York. There was resistance. So when the book was written in the fall of 1938, we had no money to get this book published, so Hank Parkhurst, who was Bill Wilson's right-hand man, his partner in crime, Hank did all the legwork on that book, And he went out and found a printer who agreed to print this book at a slow time in his rear when he wasn't doing much business. And he would print it, and he would hold the books in escrow, and when we wanted any books, we'd have to lay the books on the barrel head, and he'd give you a book. So he gave us a date that we had to have the book in there for publication. And this big argument came up between New York and Ohio about God. We wanted God, and I don't know how they could have, what kind of reasoning they used up there in New York about this God stuff, because God is actually mentioned over 200 times in our AA book, if you'll notice, but they didn't want him emphasized. So when it came to the steps where it mentions God, you will notice it in italics, it says, as I understand him, God as I understand him. The reason for that is this. The time for the publication came up, and unless something was done real quickly, we weren't going to get that book published. So we compromised in Ohio for the benefit of the agnostic boys up in New York to put as I understand it, which softened the blow for them. It was a compromise. Now, some people claim that is good, and some people claim it stinks. And I don't think it's so good either, and I'll tell you why. It gives people... An alcoholic will squeeze out of anything. He don't want to be put in a place where he can't sneak out of it. We always have to have an out or an ace somewhere. So they don't want to admit to God. People come to AA, they've been running away from him for so long, and they've had some pretty sorry experiences as far as the religion is concerned. A good many people have who come here. And when they hear that, as I understand them, some people lead them to believe they can accept anything for God. So I have heard people say that they can take for their God a chair, a desk, a light bulb. Hey, that's their God. I'll bet you heard the same crap. Let me read you this. It says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and my life had become unmanageable. Then it says, I came to believe that a light bulb could restore me to sanity. I'm not through yet. I made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of the light bulb, as I understand. I admitted to my light bulb, to ourselves and another human being, the exact nature of my wrongs. We're entirely ready to have the light bulb remove all my defects of character. Humbly ask my light bulb to remove my shortcomings. How asinine can you get? Now, I'm not the only guy here that's heard that in meetings. My God has a name. My God has a name, and I was taught this very early in my career in the Oxford movement, and God's name is Jesus. And if you don't like my God, go ahead and get your light bulb or whatever you want. But I would hate like the devil to trust my everlasting soul to a light bulb or a desk or a chair. So I have to get acquainted with who my God is. I've been introduced to him on my knees early in my career, and I do the same thing with people I bring into this fellowship. Now, just read those steps over sometime and put light bulb in there all the way down through the last one. It'll give you a lesson you'll never forget. Okay. But a person, recently in these last few years, I do not have an opportunity to sponsor new people. First of all, I don't need that exercise anymore. Grace and I have sponsored people in our home, and they go on out and they do the same kind of sponsoring that we do. And here's what happens. People come to our home, they call us from all points of the compass. I mentioned this, I think, the other night. that they hear about this freak down in Castleberry, Florida, that has some way of fixing rummies in AA who have been having a lot of problems with AA and a lot of doubts and running up a lot of blind alleys, and they're miserable. And they hear about this guy that has some way of taking them through the steps in 2 days, and they go home and they never drink anymore and they have a good life. Now, this happens all the time. This is nothing new. This has been going on for several years. So they call us. I do the best I can to sponsor people over the phone so they don't, or to qualify them rather over the phone so they don't waste a lot of their airfare coming down to our place for nothing. But you can't always do it completely, so I have a qualification when they arrive at the house. And here's what it is. Now remember, I'm interested in the bottom line. I'm not interested in what he talks about or thinks about when he gets here, he or she. They come to get what I have. I don't want what they have. That's to make that very plain. It says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths and so forth. So I don't want what they have, but they are not the happiest people in the world, believe me. And they come down to our place, and they've been in misery for a long time, some of these people. So here's my qualification. First of all, I have to know that you are an alcoholic. You have to know it, and you have to admit it. How do I know this? We do this by sharing. I have you tell me about yourself, I tell you about myself, and if this jibes and you are an alcoholic and you admit you are, I know you are, then we can go someplace. The next question I ask is, what do you want to do about it? You tell me, well, I want to quit. Well, that's fine, Buster. Lots of people will quit if I'll quit for them. And this is an old game around AA. Let George do it, you know. So they don't like to hear that too well, but next question is the one that ties them up, and to which I get some very odd answers in the beginning, many times. I say to him, what are you willing to do to quit drinking forever? Forever? Wow! This bird's never had a week's sobriety in his life and talking about forever. That's impossible. So you do get some funny answers. But there's only one answer I can accept. He has to tell me he's willing to do anything. And I'll stay with him till I think he's going to give me that answer. And when he does, it's my option to give him what I have. And if he don't want what I have, he can go home. Period. And suffer in his misery or enjoy it however he wants to do. I didn't make this up. You heard it read a little while ago. It says in our program about if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you are now ready to take certain steps. Eh? It says in that 12-step program. You hear it read at most meetings. You see it hanging on the walls in clubs. You see it in the book. It's there. I didn't make it up. I'm just talking what the AA program is. I'm not talking about BB or CC or XX. I'm talking about AA. So our program is absolute. So he says, okay, anything you say, that's it. He wants what I have. I says, what do you want? He says, anything. Now it's my option. The ball's in my court. He has no option to argue with me. I am the authority then, because he knows that he's whipped and he's come to me for help, and I'm going to give him the medicine. And here's the medicine. First step says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. It says something else there. Our lives had become unmanageable. Most people I have found that come my way have never heard the second part of that step. Or if they have, they have paid no attention to it. They hear that first part, I'm powerless over alcohol, and that's all they hear. So they yammer about alcohol for month after month and year after year till they're dizzy and make everybody else dizzy listen to them. It's on their mind all the time. They're powerless over alcohol. They don't hear that thing about their life being unmanageable, and that is the most important part of the step. Because you come here screwed up, your life's unmanageable, and you come here to get it manageable. People don't realize that. There are 200 well-chosen words in our 12-step program, and if you look at it, you'll find alcohol is only mentioned once. Once. That's in the first part of the first step. But from that time on, that point on, there's an awful lot said about getting our life manageable. This program is a living program. It's not a dry or drunk program. The fact that we are alcoholics, that is a key when we are powerless over alcohol. That's the key that opens the door where we have an opportunity to learn how to live. If we did not have this, we would never have this opportunity. You know, we are the most fortunate of all people, because all down through history, they didn't have any out for alcoholics, as I mentioned. Now we have it. We have the out for the alcoholic, and you and I are the people who have to spread this word and carry this message. There's no one else to do it but you and I. So that would mean that we better find out what it's all about and how to distinguish things and how to put this program across to other people who need it so badly. Alcoholics Anonymous is not what it says in that preamble. This is an association for alcoholics who want to do something about their life, who want to quit. Not for anybody dingbat that wants to come in and sit down. This isn't an entertainment. This is not a circus. This is not a movie show. This is a life-changing program. And we come here, and it's the only chance we ever have of getting a good life is to change our life, because we're so screwed up when we get here. But unless somebody takes charge of us and sponsors us and teaches us, we're going to have a hard time getting on this program, because we are going to shy away from the fundamental things that this program calls for. People come here, they're full of fear. They've had all kinds of rotten experiences in religion. They're scared to death of God. They have some funny ideas about who he is. To most people, they have the same silly idea that I used to have. I've told this before, but my idea of God when I arrived here was some old man sitting up on a white throne with a long white nightgown, long white beard, writing dirty things in a book about me. He's going to fix me, boy. And I learned all that stuff when I was a kid. I was given those impressions when I was a kid. What do you think that did to my life? I'm no different than you are. You got the same dose. That's why you're here. Well, I take them down this program now. I admitted we're powerless over alcohol, and that my life is unmanageable. So now you're going to start getting your life managed, and here's the way we do it. The second step, I might say people fail in AA in step one because they don't see that second part of that step, and they fail in step three and step four, and I'll go into that in a minute. The second step says, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Now, I didn't say I believed that when I arrived here. I certainly didn't. Doc made me get down there, admit that I knew God and knew of him and believed in him. But I didn't have any conception about this power greater than myself restoring me to any sanity. And I know there's a lot of people that feel the same way, so they skip that. But how did I come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity? It is the power of example of these men who preceded me. These 14 men walked into that hospital room and talked to me, the alcoholics, and told me their stories. And these fellows were laughing. It's been a long time since I had anything to laugh about, believe me. And they had something I wanted. There was something, their kinship there, and I wanted what they had, and I wanted to be one of them. I wanted to belong to something. I didn't belong to the human race when I got here, really. So I came to believe that in this power greater than myself that I call God, because they told me they believed in it, and if I did, he would do the same thing for me that he did for them. And I wanted to believe it. That's the whole thing. Not that I believed when I got here. to this next step. Made a decision. Isn't that something for a rummy to do? We are the most indecisive people in the world. And here we're making a decision already. I made a decision. Listen to this one. To turn my will and my life over to the care of God. That creature with the nightgown back there that I'm scared to death of and running away from. Believe me, if I don't hurt a whole lot, I'm not about to do that. I can't do that on common sense because I don't have any common sense. It says back in that second step that we're going to be restored to sanity. I lapse. Some of these people, it's serious. I'm serious about this. People say to me on that second step, well, I'm not nuts. You're not nuts. If you're not nuts, you don't belong here. This is the greatest collection of nuts in the world. We are qualified. If you don't think you're nuts, just look back a bit and consider some of the details that you occurred in during your drinking career and ask yourself if those are the antics of a sane mind. We are all crazy. We're nuts. So we get restored to sanity. So I made a decision to turn my will and life over to this care of God. And as I say, you're not going to do that unless you hurt real badly. Alcoholics never do anything by common sense or thinking. Never. It's by emotion. It's how we feel. If we feel a certain way, we'll do something. If we don't, all the king's horses are not going to change it. So if we hurt enough, we're going to make this decision because there's no other place to go. We've just worn out all the outs for ourselves. So this is our last go-round. One of the first things I have to do when a person comes to my house is I try to give him a good feeling about himself, a good self-image. They come to our house with the poorest image of themselves. It's pitiful to see some of these poor ducks, and they've been around for several years or many years in AA. Some of them drunk, some not, but still miserable. And they have an awful poor image of themselves. So I have to build up their self-esteem right off the bat. How do I do this? I tell him who the alcoholic is. I describe the alcoholic and tell him about the virtues we have. And we have them. Alcoholics have characteristics in common. And we've got looking at these characteristics. And boy, we got things on these other earth people they never dreamed of. And in fact, alcoholics are a superior type of person. Alkies have a type of imagination and ingenuity and so forth that other people can't dream about. I've often said about alcoholics that they can operate on 20 or 30% of their efficiency and beat civilians who are operating on 80% of theirs. They can do it. And you know alcoholics, you being one, you know what you've done. When you're really fogged up, you get by with a lot of stuff. The other people couldn't do this. If I had the time, I'd tell you some experiences of my own along that line, just to give you evidence. But take my word for it. We are a superior type of person. Every alcoholic is a drunk, but every drunk is not an alcoholic. This is a thing people get confused on, too. Just because a guy drinks a lot of booze or a gal drinks a lot, that don't make him an alcoholic. I drank with fellas in bottle gangs that drank as much booze as I did and the same kind of crap that I drank. They were not alcoholics. They could quit any time they got a different hobby. I couldn't do that. I remember one time, just as an example, there was a bottle gang I used to drink with out in the last house I lived in before my wife threw me out for good. And this bunch, we used to get into all kinds of stuff. Oh, we stole one bartender out of business. We crashed weddings. Any place that's having a wedding, we invited ourselves. Nobody knew. Everybody's half drunk anyway, and we just went and we got a lot of free booze. They'd go out and do all kinds of crazy things. The police chief down there, we didn't like him. He's always sticking his nose in our business. And the city bought him it was a little village I was in out there. They bought him a new police car one day, a Ford. They put all the lights on it and the whole thing, you know. And where I was living, they used to park in a median strip out there in front of that bar room. And he used to park his car out there in that meeting, keep the motor running, get the battery up, I guess. He got that brand new car, and he had it 2 days. And while several people engaged him in conversation, several others went out the back door and stole that damn police car. And the place wasn't built up. We took it way down in the woods and hid it. He didn't find that car for 3 weeks. If he'd ever found out who was involved in that, we'd all been lathered, believe me. But this is the kind of crazy stuff these guys would do. We'd crash parties, go any place. They put on a fake fight. They get a fight started in a political meeting. Oh, it was something fun. They were having fun. I went on the bum, disappeared, and I was gone for some years. And one day, I was sober for a number of years, and I was having a lot of throat trouble. I was having a series of operations for tumors in my throat. As going through one of those things where you go to a hospital and then you have to go home and get strong enough to come back and have another operation. It's one of those miserable things. And I went downtown one day. I was going to the ball game. I wanted to go down and see the New York Yankees play. I used to like to see those fellas. Joe DiMaggio was one of my favorite ball players. And so Joe was coming to town that day. And so I went down to the ball game. I was a very sick duck. I was lost weight. My clothes were hanging on me. And I'm walking down there and down that West Superior Street. It's a whole line of saloons there. And here I walk, bingo, right smack dab into four guys I used to drink with in a bottle gang years ago. Now, remember, those guys were real. Those are the fellas I'm talking about who used to do all this stuff. It's four of them, and they're all dolled up. They have pongee shirts on. They have white pants and two-tone shoes. And they're all lit. I mean, they're all drunk, having a great old time. They're just enjoying everything. They're on the way to the ball game, too. And I noticed something. They each had a box seat ticket stuck in their shirt pocket there for the ball game. My God, when we were all getting together, we can raise the price of a ticket in 2 weeks, a whole bunch of us put together. And they were working. They were in business. They were doing fine. The war had come along eventually, and everybody got to work. Those guys were doing great. They were still having fun drinking. They said, "Snyder, you old goat, we haven't seen you. We thought you were dead." Well, I looked about half dead at the time, and he says, "Come on in, have a drink." Now, they were under 90 pounds of steam then, these guys were. We go into one of those joints, and boy, they're throwing them in just like they used to, no different. I stand there looking at these clowns, just thinking, if all I had to do was join them, I'd be back on that skid row again. That didn't worry them. They're not alcoholics. They're heavy drinkers. A lot of those heavy drinkers don't have sense enough to be an alcoholic. You have to have something on the stick to be a rummy. You're an exceptional person. You really are. I don't care what you look at. If you're a nurse, a doctor, if you're a teacher, if you're a salesman, whatever you are, a mechanic, you'll always find the alcoholics in the top 10. Always. I became a salesman after I came into AA. I wasn't a salesman before, but I could never go on back in banking and finance after I got in. I wasn't properly equipped for that, and I don't think I could handle it anyway. But I went into sales work, and I did various types of selling. I worked for one concern that had over 600 salesmen in the United States and Canada, and for 7 years I was with that outfit, I was always in the top 10. Top 10. I'm a rummy. I suppose the other nine guys were too. I trained a lot of salesmen. I worked in various sales capacities. I've been a sales manager. I trained men. The best salesmen I ever found were rummies. If you could keep the buttery guys sober, you got world beaters. They could outsell anything, anybody. That's a fact. So think well of yourself. You got things that other people don't have. Don't let those people run you down and tell you what a bum you are. Kick them in the teeth. Stand up for yourself. People apologizing because they belong to AA. That's the most asinine thing I ever heard of. Go out and tell them you belong to AA. Tell them you're doing something. It kills me. These birds have been crawling around on their hands.